Henry Thoreau, wrote Ralph Waldo Emerson, is like the wood god who solicits the wandering poet. Emerson went on. Very seductive are the first steps from the town to the woods, but the end is want and madness. Emerson, I believe, meant this as a knock. Thoreau's friend and mentor was also a critic. But on the day I'm releasing this podcast, it'll have been 205 years to the day since Thoreau's birth on July 12, 1817, and the wood god of Walden Pond continues to seduce wandering poets, philosophers, and revolutionaries the world over. His sylvan siren song has beguiled some of history's most influential rebels, from Mahatma Gandhi to Martin Luther King Jr. to Emma Goldman. Their transformative legacies suggest the wanton madness found by Emerson weren't the end but a beginning. This is more or less how I began an essay I wrote 5 years ago for Thoreau's 200th birthday, a short book review of Henry David Thoreau, A Life by Laura Dessau Walls. Today, 5 years later, I'll be speaking to another Thoreau scholar, Alda Bothrop Lewis, about her book, Thoreau's Religion, Walden Woods, Social Justice, and the Politics of Asceticism. Alda is now a research fellow in the Institute for Religion and Critical Inquiry at Australian Catholic University. But before that, she was a PhD student in religion, ethics, and politics at Princeton University at the same time that I was an undergraduate there, and we were actually in a book club together. So this was a nice opportunity for us to have a sort of two-person book club about her book on Henry David Thoreau. At this point, I should say, because I haven't already, welcome to Storytelling Animals, a Green New podcast of climate ecology and animal justice, where we use books to make sense of the environmental crisis. For perhaps it's not that surprising that an environmental books podcast should turn to Thoreau on his 205th birthday and celebrate him to some extent, but I think it's worth explaining exactly why I think this figure is worth remembering and specifically worth learning from. There have certainly been many developments in environmental politics since the 1800s, and as Alda points out, no one is obligated to count Thoreau as among their influences or someone they'd like to learn from. But I think some might turn away or be disinterested due to misunderstandings. This is a big part of what Alda's book is about, clearing up certain misunderstandings about Thoreau's politics, his sense of community, his theological commitments, and it's a big part of what our conversation is about, both what are the misunderstandings people have about Thoreau, and why did these misunderstandings come about? Alda suggests that part of it is that the intellectual and university establishment of the last century was ultimately more interested in the Thoreau who enjoyed taking nature walks than in the Thoreau who, connected those nature walks into a larger political project that included opposition to industrial capitalism, to colonial expansion, to slavery, and racial oppression. I also talk about, and I want to sort of clarify here because I'm less articulate than I would like to be in the actual interview. Most people in the United States first encounter Thoreau through a high school English class. And one thing that I remember noticing in high school English is that, everyone from not only Thoreau to Melville to Mark Twain to John Steinbeck, a lot of these sort of canonical, even the white male canon, for all its flaws, is often extremely critical of the status quo, extremely critical of the social, economic, racial order as it is. And it always kind of struck me as interesting that the, popular figures that we were presented to in school were so critical of the status quo, and yet, no matter how good your English teacher was, and mine was good, you're ultimately at a public school that's not going to tell you to overthrow the government or something like that. It's perhaps a related phenomenon to what happens to Martin Luther King Jr., where conservatives turn him into some sort of publicly lionized figure, remembered for saying that, people shouldn't be judged by the color of their skin. And they use that as an argument against, reparations or any sort of racial justice policy, when, in fact, King's own politics were fairly radical and socialist and subversive and critical of U.S. imperialism. But, you know, when a figure like that is embraced by the status quo, they often defang their, most challenging and often most important messages. Thoreau, I'm not saying, is the exact same for a variety of reasons, partly because even after he's been defanged, he doesn't necessarily appeal to everyone. He's still telling people to simplify, and he's doing his thing, living by the pond. And maybe it's easier to, call him too much of a purist or say he was a hypocrite or cranky. And, maybe this is part of why Emerson was, had his skepticisms, as I mentioned at the very beginning. But I, to be honest, like the side of Thoreau too. Alda and I sort of talk about why his ascetic practices, his practices of living in a certain way and avoiding certain things, and leaning into certain things, such as his joy in living in the woods, sort of combine to create a practice that is not only just kind of his personal thing, but something with political implications, just as political as his other writings that more explicitly address, social issues of the day, and in fact very connected to those writings. And then we also look at what this might mean for, contemporary environmental discussions, both about, the role of personal practices in general, in social change, and what we can learn from Thoreau. A quick reminder before we start that we are now 2 weeks out from our Ministry for the Future book club meeting. For more information on how to join that, go to DaytonMartindale.com/book-club. That's Tuesday, June 26th. If you like this podcast, follow it, share it, subscribe to my newsletter, send it to your high school English teacher, support it on Patreon, or just enjoy it. Hi, I'm here with Alda Balthrop Lewis, the author of Thoreau's Religion, Walden Woods, Social Justice, and the Politics of Asceticism. Alda, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me, Dayton. It's great to talk.
Yeah. So the book is about Henry David Thoreau. We're doing this interview in late June, but we're going to release it to the public on Thoreau's birthday, which is July 12th. Why is Henry David Thoreau still, and obviously we'll get into specifics later, but why is he still a relevant, important figure? Why should we be still interested in what he thought and wrote about 150, 60 years later?
Yeah, that's such an interesting question. I'm not sure everybody should. one of the things I think that this book, Thoreau's Religion, is saying is Thoreau is important to some people. That's just a sort of empirical fact. And for those people, the question is, what do we make of his legacy? And so I think there are probably plenty of people in the world who don't really care and don't need to. But for those of us who do still have an interest, I think the main thing the book tries to say is that the image of Thoreau a lot of us have received is of a kind of singular individualist in a lonely, pull yourself up by your bootstraps adventure. Whereas one of the things the book tries to say is that that image of Thoreau that a lot of us have has come to us through a reception history that was perverted by white supremacy and other forms of colonial violence. And that when we read him now with the more equitable environmental politics that are emerging in our time in mind, we can see that he's more of an ally to contemporary movements than we might have thought. So I guess that's why I'm still interested.
I am also still interested in Thoreau. There's only been a figure, one of the few figures in the past that I genuinely do admire, warts and all. But
why are you still interested in Thoreau?
Yeah, I think it's because of what I want to talk about next, which is the way in which he blends like genuine love of the non-human world, of the, you know, the other creatures, animals and plants with whom he interacted, and is genuinely like concerned for their well-being and for the flourishing of the rest of the earth. And in that same breath is, you know, and maybe even on the same page of his journal, is fuming about slavery, about like capitalism and worker exploitation, about the war in Mexico, and just the way that his concern for all beings is not like put again, won't put one against the other, but just seems to come from the same wellspring. Yeah. Is I think a useful model. And the other thing is that I sort of appreciate his, like, I do think that we should simplify. I appreciate kind of the more aesthetic, kind of renunciation of certain, you know, consumerist material pleasures, but that doesn't mean a joyless life. And in fact, he seemed like he was having a heck of a good time.
That's right.
So, yeah.
One of the arguments in the book that I'm really invested in is like this image that we get of the lonely Thoreau really, I think, undermines that delight that you're pointing to, that he especially in Walden, so my book is mostly about Walden, his delight, he goes to the woods to find out if living simply, what it would be like. What would it be like to live the kind of life that doesn't require coercive labor of others? Mm-hmm. And what he finds is that it's beautiful. Like, he really enjoys it. And so I think it's important, that thing you've just described, to point out that there are reasons to doubt that the excesses of industrialism actually are always to our benefit.
Mm-hmm. You said earlier like that our reception of Thoreau has been somewhat colored by like a white supremacist history. One of the things you bring up at one point in the book is there was this 2015 article in, I think, The Atlantic, that, and there are articles like this, you know, every once in a while, that it's just like, we should stop caring about Thoreau. He was, you know, selfish and unlikable, etc. But you, in the book, you point out that one of the things that this article said was, you know, I can't respect anyone who doesn't drink coffee, or something along those lines. And what you pointed out is, at the time Thoreau was living, like, a lot of abolitionists were avoiding coffee because of slave labor. And I should add that I actually don't drink coffee, not for any particularly admirable reason, as a fear of caffeine addiction. But
yeah, so, I can't sleep if I drink it.
So I side with Henry in the debate here, as I often
no
do.
No more coffee. Me and Dana side.
But if my listeners drink coffee, it's okay. But I guess why I bring this up is like, that it's easier to see, for some people anyway, to, you know, see him as a hypocrite or a scold or a killjoy, and maybe sometimes see some of those things, but not see the political context of the time. So why do you think we get this image of, you know, the individualist hermit and not this image of like the radical abolitionist?
Yeah. I mean, this is all kind of a hypothesis, but my guess is that literary interpretations through the course of the 20th century, Reconstruction ended, right? And Jim Crow began, and our universities were dominated by, were elite institutions, dominated by white readers. And that reception history has meant that those of us like me, I grew up in Florida, I'm a white settler from the United States. I live in Australia now on Wurundjeri and Drake country, where I'm grateful to live. Readers with advantages like me in that political context found it much easier, I think, to enjoy and admire the beautiful descriptions of sort of peaceful, unharried life in the woods than they did to really take to heart the fundamental critique at the base of Thoreau's life and thought, which was about just labor. So I think he was concerned that a life that relied on unjust labor, as so many of ours do, wasn't a good life. And part of what the Walden Project was about was trying to figure out what a life, as I said, what a life would look like that tried not to do that, tried not to rely on unjust labor. And that, like, the fact that wealth is a problem in the ways he thought it was, is uncomfortable for people of privilege. And so we're less inclined, I think, to pay attention to it than we are to the way that owls sound and how nice it is to simplify and those things. I mean, yeah. What do you think about that hypothesis? I'm not sure that's right.
I don't know that I feel like super qualified to speak authoritatively, but I think it makes sense. I think that there have always been parts of the environmental movement that share this blend of ecological thinking and radical, like, politics and support for social justice, but that there have also been parts that like a conception of the environment and don't really connect it to anything else, and probably these parts have more like social power, and especially during the 1900s. So it would make sense if what they were interested in Thoreau was what became standard. But I think also, like, if I just think back to sort of my, you know, high school experience reading Walden, I think even then, when I didn't necessarily have like a fully fleshed out radical politics or anything, there was some element of that the people we were reading in English class all seemed like to be politically very radical and pushing boundaries and like critical of the world as it exists. Mm-hmm. In a way that I don't know if it's just because not everyone loves English class or not everyone does the summer reading, or when you do the summer reading, you're like trying to cram through it rather than sort of savoring it and sitting with it. I remember thinking at the time, like, I like this book, but I feel like I would like it more if I read it more slowly, because mm-hmm. I was reading it fast because I had to read it before school started.
I have a friend who told me when she was reading it that that she's a woman I really admire, who lived a long, wise life, and she was probably in her 80s when she read it for the first time, because I was working on this book, and that was very touching. And she also said that she thought you shouldn't read really more than a paragraph at a time, and maybe just one sentence at a time.
Yeah, and so I think that it's great that it's taught in schools, and like I think my high school teacher, if you're listening, Kathy Schulteis, did an excellent job with it, and we went to walk around the local pond in the park one day, and I really enjoyed that, and I remember learning about transcendentalism, and it was at a time where I was raised Catholic, and junior year of high school is kind of when I was really starting to question that, and like learning about transcendentalism, I was like, is anyone still this?
yes, we are.
But yeah, like it made an impact on me, but I think that just the fact that it's coming from our public school maybe softened some of the I don't know, maybe we all read it. Like, I remember the walk around the pond from high school, and I remember that more than I remember some of the radical political elements, even though they're there. And sure. I think maybe it wasn't until reading some of his, like, his essay on slavery in Massachusetts, or his essay on Life Without Principle, or John Brown. I'll link some of these in the episode description. But that I getting a fuller sense of his political views through those, and then returning to, I haven't reread Walden in full, but I've, you know, reread excerpts, and I've read a lot of his journal from that time that he was at Walden.
Yeah.
And I think you see it more because sometimes he's subtle and sometimes he's jokey. Like there's great stuff in your book about, like, everyone thought he was hilarious. Like, whenever he gave speeches, people loved it. And I think it's sometimes the type of humor that, you know, because it's two centuries later, you know, needs to be explained by the English teacher.
Yeah, 19th century prose is not intuitive to most of us. And it is kind of hard. I mean, if you're 16 years old, then you just try to pick it up. Mm-hmm. It would be impressive if you came away with, like, a really synthetic reading. I think that's right. Yeah. It's interesting it's still taught in public schools. I wonder if it's still on the curriculum now. I haven't checked, you know, like, I don't know what the latest is, but I think for a long time it's been something sort of everyone who went to public school read at some point or another, and that's kind of amazing and interesting mm-hmm. in itself. And as you say, like, that history gets us some things. Like, it's so great you remember the walk around the pond more than the book, and I think that's kind of beautiful.
Well, because we were supposed to write down what we observed and stuff, and I have no idea what I wrote down, but it was just kind of a very nice change of pace from a typical classroom.
Yeah. Yep. And I think so much of what he's saying in Walden is like, look at the things that are around you. And it's true, I think, that especially teenagers don't always feel like the people who are teaching them actually value what they see. So it's an exceptional mm-hmm. English teacher who says, I want to know what you see.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think all of that, I think what you said about the people in power are more interested in his nature commentary than in his politics, and so that's what they would highlight. I think also everyone, or not everyone, but lots of people I talk to still have this idea that he went to the woods to be a hermit. And even just a cursory reading of Walden, you don't have to look too deep. It's not what he's trying to do. 'Cause there are, as you point out in your first chapter, there's like his social life and society, although in some cases unconventional, is a big part of the book. So what was his society while he was living at Walden?
Yeah. So the first chapter in my book tries to make this argument that, you know, we've received an image of him as asocial in some way, sort of refusing sociality. And it's really easy to get that impression from things that he says, because he's cranky like me. and there are some people he doesn't like, probably like most of us. But I think that one of the reasons we get that impression, the sort of asocial impression about his life in Walden Woods, is that we ourselves have emptied the woods of its other inhabitants besides him in our imaginations. So both with respect to the other beings that were living there at the time, including some people who lived in the woods and worked in the woods, that he reports, you know, making friendships with and talking to, the other, you know, creatures that are animals besides humans, that he has all kinds of relationships with, including, I think, as one of the examples I give is about chickadees, these kind of moment when he and a friend who worked in the woods were talking, and the chickadees arrive and they listen to what the chickadee says, and they have this kind of interlinguistic encounter. And then also one of the main ways we get the asocial picture of his life in Walden Woods, I think, is by not remembering that it had been the site of what he called a small village of people, many of whom had formerly been enslaved and conquered. So in the generation before Thoreau, people who had been enslaved and conquered became free around the time of the American Revolution and were not really welcome in Concord except in lives of service similar to the ones they had lived before slavery. But some of these newly freed people chose not to live lives of service and instead made their lives in the woods and near Walden Pond. So Thoreau recounts in the middle of Walden in this passage that's called Former Inhabitants what he learned about these people who had lived there in the generation before him, I think probably from something like oral history. You know, he talked to the people that he knew and trying to find out what he could about their lives. And in fact, there's a really great book about this called Black Walden by Elise Lemire. And it recounts everything that Lemire could find out about the people who had been enslaved and conquered. When we forget that those people lived in the woods before Thoreau, I think we imagine that he was the first inhabitant of that place. And it obviously wasn't just them who lived there before him, but the First Nations of the region. And he took that heritage. I mean, he knew about it, and I think he cared about it. And I think that he took them as exemplary people, as people who had, in very trying circumstances, tried to figure out how to live lives outside of domination, which is a very difficult thing to do in America.
Yeah, I think, you know, he has his society in the town and visiting friends and family, but also this, you do a good job painting in the book that the woods themselves are full of history and even in the present, people who we often overlook. So the second chapter is kind of this idea of Thoreau as apolitical. What's funny, and you mentioned this too with the social, like, I guess he does kind of contribute a little sometimes with, you can find cranky quotes where, you know, I don't like, he doesn't say outright, but like that he doesn't like being around people. And then, you know, you also see him spending time with people, but similarly with politics, you know, he has quotes about, you know, not liking the news or not, you know, not caring what's going on in the world.
Yeah, people read too many newspapers, and that government is best, which governs least.
Yes. But that he is also actually very concerned with this world. I think there's a quote in his Slavery of Massachusetts essay, that it's after the Fugitive Slave Act is passed, and it's like, remembrance of my country like spoils my walks. And he's not able to, like, despite the image put forward, he is actually extremely conscious of what is happening in the world while he's in the woods. And while he's in Walden, he also gets, arrested for refusing to pay his tax. because of slavery and the war in Mexico. So the other interesting thing about it here is that even the, like, live simply, light upon the land, like, don't buy a lot of stuff, that part is part of the politics, too. There's a good example you have about, like, when he writes about clothing, that, you know, it's not just that he is against all material goods, but he specifically is writing about, you know, clothes these days are made not to, you know, be sturdy, functional clothing, but to enrich the corporations that make them. And, you know, in kind of making critiques of capitalism that you wouldn't have to change much to feel relevant now. So what, while he's at Walden, what are, like, some of the major political trends and issues of that time, and how do they affect the book Walden?
Yeah, so one of the things that I'm trying to describe in that chapter, so the book is sort of organized around these three images people have. The first chapter is about how people think of him as asocial, and I'm like, hang on, there's a society. The second chapter recognizes that people think of him as apolitical, and I'm like, hang on, here's some politics. And the third chapter talks about how people think of him as a-religious, and there I talk about the sort of religious motivations for some of these political investments and interests. So in that second chapter about the politics, I go from this example about clothing to acknowledge that in Lowell, just up the river from Concord, and the river that Thoreau traveled on with his brother John, in the trip that he wrote about in his first book, A Week on the Concord and Merrimack Rivers, Lowell had been, around the time that he and John were traveling down the river, the site of the first labor organizing among women workers in the United States. They had staged strikes to try to limit the workday to 10 hours. And his interest in the politics of labor in the North was political in more than just the sense that he cared about labor politics in the North, because among Northern abolitionists, one of the central fault lines was over what the alternative to slavery ought to be. So if people in the South who were promoting slavery said there has to be some kind of labor system, people in the North had different responses to what that labor system should be. And some Northern abolitionists, like William Lloyd Garrison, perhaps most famously, were, there's controversy in the literature about this, but were relatively sanguine about what was called wage labor, free labor sometimes, that would was the kind of employment that these women workers at Lowell were contracted to do. Thoreau took a different view. He thought that wage labor posed problems that weren't usually being addressed by Northern abolitionists, and he was hoping that the abolition of slavery and the reformation of what he didn't describe as, but I'm going to just say as a shorthand, exploitative wage labor conditions in the North could both be reformed. Slavery in the South and wage labor in the North could both be reformed into an economy in which all people could be free from domination.
Mm-hmm. One of the other ideas you bring up that I forget exactly where in the book, but is this idea of things held in common as opposed to things held privately. What does Thoreau have to say about things held in common?
Yeah, this is one of the things he's worried about wealth. He says at one point, I'm not going to be able to remember the quote exactly, but he says at one point in the Critique of Philanthropy, which I talk about in the chapter about how Thoreau is motivated in some ways by kind of theological views. He describes how philanthropists give some portion of their wealth, and lots of people think that that's a good thing. But Thoreau is worried that when a philanthropist gives a small portion of their wealth, they actually withhold from society what's due to it, because he thinks that in a lot of cases, the wealth held by individuals is probably made via a form of robbery of lands and of labor. And so he's pretty suspicious of private property. And especially because he liked to walk, he's mad about fences because they get in the way. Mm-hmm.
I think this gets at some of why I admire him and enjoy him so much, is like, I appreciate the crank aspect of just like, who put a fence in the way of my walk, or, you know, that he gets mad about things that maybe we should all be more mad about.
That's right. Yeah, it wasn't always this way. It's a relatively recent private property and fences in the way we practice them now are relatively recent in European legal history.
So the title of the book, Thoreau's Religion, you've alluded to a few times that you make an argument about his theological motivations, but what do we mean by religion?
Mm-hmm. So the I sort of use religion in the book. The reason it appears in the title is that I use religion and related key terms like divinity, spirit, virtue, piety, these kind of a cluster of terms that often appear together or in related ways in Thoreau's writing. I try to read those parts because it's been true in Thoreau's reception that because he and other transcendentalists were in some dissent from Christian orthodoxy of their period, they've been read as outside the sort of mainstream of Christian orthodoxy. And that's led, I think, a lot of literary interpreters to sort of turn away from the places where Thoreau alludes to the Bible and uses these kind of reverential terms. So I use interpretations of passages like that throughout the book that I wrote. So when I say religion in the title, it's mostly about where he writes about religion and related terms, because it was an important category to him. It stood for, I mean, he uses it in a few different ways, as I think many of us do. For him, I think there's at least three different senses. There's one that's sort of a negative sense, where religion is the kind of thing that ties you to bad habits. There's a kind of neutral sense that's just like any habit, habitual behavior, doing things on the regular. And then there's a good sense, and one like religion in the true sense appears also in his writing, and has a kind of positive connotation. He loves the religion of the Romans. Ancient Roman religion sometimes seems to be his favorite because they had piety for forests, especially, I think. So he's got all of these kind of, and he's reading some Indian philosophy that is newly available in the United States, the Bhagavad Gita and others. He's got a really eclectic sense of what kinds of practices lead humans toward flourishing relationship to spirits or something like that. And so I'm trying to read in a sense what that's about in his writing, where that comes from, why he cares about it. Yeah.
Yeah, I think there's this line in a letter you quote in his book where he says something along the lines of, you know, God reigns. Well, I don't know if God's the right word, but you know who I mean.
Yeah, I love that. He's cagey about God, but he acknowledges God sometimes. Mm-hmm.
But he talks about God and the divine. And you mentioned he's critical of at least certain types of Christianity, and he's sometimes, you know, favorably compares either Hindu holy texts or Roman religion you mentioned. In what sense does he, if any, does he fit within the Christian tradition?
So the argument I make in the chapter that's most focused on these questions is that he wages this like really strong critique of Christian philanthropy, which is the sort of orthodox, the most common response among Christians to the poor. So like what Christians think virtuousness is in a society where there are poor people is, he thinks, philanthropy, charity, giving. And he thinks that's wrong. And he makes the argument specifically on theological grounds. So a lot of Christians thought it was sort of like against Christian virtue because they assumed that Christian virtue was giving wealth to the poor. But Thoreau is contesting what the appropriate response to the poor is according to the gospel. So he thinks that Jesus's message is more like we ought to have a just society than it is like the rich ought to give some of their money to the poor. And I think he thinks that because of a certain reading of Jesus's sayings in what he read, which was the King James Bible. So, and there were, he wasn't alone in this view in the period. Other dissenters had views similar, but there's a sense in which that sort of the insistence on a kind of the radicality of Jesus's message about wealth, meaning like the rich man can't, it's easier for the rich man to pass through for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to go to heaven. To read that passage literally just isn't very common in Christian history, and Thoreau does.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because you talked toward the end about this influential essay by Lynn White, which is, I encountered it in undergrad, that traces at least some of the roots of the environmental crisis to Christianity, or at least the, you know, conventional conception within Christianity of humans having dominion over the rest of the earth. To what extent is there something to that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, Christian history is long and complicated, and I think that piece by Lynn White is has such a prominent place in the way people have thought about religion and environment since it came out in 67, I think. Christianity definitely found itself allied in many contexts and still does. I mean, one obvious example in the United States to worldly political powers. So that's just an old story. And so I think there's something to it. I think like, you know, colonialism itself is led by Christians trying to missionize, and
which Thoreau was critical of, to his credit.
Yeah. So there's something to it. One of the really interesting things I think about that Lynn White piece is that despite his articulation of the way that this Christian view emerged that saw humans as like in dominion in some way that allowed for exploitation. He suggests that they could take up the banner of Francis of Assisi, who's, you know, a canonized saint. So I think even that Lynn White piece describes this kind of tension at the heart of the tradition, at least the tradition's history, on the one hand, kind of allied to worldly powers and asserting a dominative view of nature, and on the other hand, in some instances, insisting on a more egalitarian image of God's creation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think we have the ingredients we need in this to move toward the idea of asceticism. What is asceticism?
Yeah, so it's exercises. It's any regular practice a person does. In the ancient Greek, ascesis just means exercise, but it's taken up in ancient Greek philosophy and then through that into Christian history, often in a kind of there are necessary renunciations for some of the exercises that are described in these traditions. So one classic example of asceticism are monks and nuns who renounce wealth, sex, and poverty? Oh yeah, autonomy. Because they make vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience. So they renounce some things in order to make a life of piety. And so that's one, monks and nuns are one kind of example of asceticism. And in the book, I try to say that Thoreau is drawing on these kinds of traditions, both in Christian traditions, but also he says he's really pro voluntary poverty is the word he uses for this in the beginning of Walden. And he says the geniuses of voluntary poverty are the ancients, Greek, Persian, Chinese, and Hindu. So he's drawing on really diverse philosophical and religious traditions to try to find a way of life that is oriented toward this kind of flourishing in common. And that's what I think is really being represented in Walden, is this like life of piety through some renunciation, but also oriented toward a positive end, the kind of enjoyment we were talking about at the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and how does, I think the worry about asceticism for some might be that, you know, great, you go, maybe today you go live off grid and forage and hunt all your food and, you know, have solar panels on your roof and great, you're make maybe a very, very slight dent that in energy use, in, you know, food consumption that no one really notices and does nothing to slow the impending, you know, disaster of ecological crisis. Which I'm torn on, because in some ways I genuinely do admire the person who does that.
Sure.
But I also, and you know, in my smaller way, I do try to do a lot to, I do try to buy less. I do eat vegan. I do try to fly less. I bike or take the bus to get around. I try to do these things, and they are, I think I like the idea that you just brought up of kind of seeing them as a practice, as, you know, there are ways in which I, like daily reassert my commitment to,
yeah,
you know, fighting climate change and fighting other environmental problems and fighting for justice and against Amazon or whatever. But I feel like there's kind of this, catch 22 of like, if you talk about it too much, you're preachy, which is what some people call Thoreau, but if you don't talk about it at all, then nobody knows, nobody cares, and did you really do that much? So how does Thoreau, bringing it back to him, make his asceticism something political? Because the subtitle, Social Justice and the Politics of Asceticism. What is political asceticism?
Yeah. So I try to say, I think maybe two things. I'm not sure I'm as clear about this in the book as I want to be. But I think I say maybe two things. And I think the first is those practices themselves are a form of politics. They may not be like when you ride your bike and avoid the emissions that will come from a car. It may not be. It's not going to end climate change.
Dang.
But I think we do ourselves we get confused about scale, and I think when we describe that act in the scale that's appropriate to it. So like what you, Dayton, do in your life and the impact that it makes in your neighborhood. And when we describe it at a scale that's appropriate, that's human sized, it looks different. And I think it's important to remember the scale that we live at, because if I feel disappointed, as I often do, that I don't have the power to enact the kinds of transformations that I want to see in the world, we sometimes fail to see the powers that we do have. So like, those are the powers that you have, Dayton, and you are using them. And like, I think that's great. So that's one thing. It's like, those individual humans shouldn't aim to have greater powers than they do. Like we're just people, and we're living in neighborhoods. We're doing the best that we can at the scale at which we live. And some of us have like policy positions, and those people have different responsibilities. And some of us have families that we care for, and those people have different responsibilities. Each of us is in a different position, and each of us has different powers. And the thing that we each have to do is to find the powers that we have and use them to try to affect the transformation we want to see. And when we're demoralized by the fact that our powers aren't greater than they are, we should join up with our neighbors, you know, like, it's not a problem that I'm just a human-sized person. So the first thing I think is that those practices themselves are more important to politics than I think we're accustomed to imagining that they are. And that's, I think, a really important thing to say. But then the other thing, and maybe these two things are connected in a way through, I try to make this argument about writing as a practice, an aesthetic practice. Mm-hmm. Which is that even the things that I do at a human scale in my loneliest moments, like writing, might have broader effects than I see right now or can anticipate. And I think the best example we have of that in this context for this argument is Walden itself, the right book, which Thoreau wrote over the course of 10 years, took a lot of care. It was kind of contemplative process. A lot of it was quite lonely. He must have thought it wasn't going to make that big of a difference in the world. And nonetheless, you and I are here on his 105th birthday talking about why it matters to us. I just turned 39 yesterday. It's like a season of birthdays. And like, it helps us to do the work that we're doing, which is to try to make a livable future for humans that will come after us and all creatures, all beings. So, and for the ones, I mean, you know, everyone. So I guess those are two ways in which it seems to me that asceticism has been under-described as a political, sometimes, not always, obviously. But there are some of these really important instances of ascetics who are motivated by this desire to see justice enacted in the world, did these acts of renunciation of wealth, especially, but also of autonomy and and family, and made a difference in the politics and the economies that came after them. So those are some of the ways that asceticism might be political in some cases.
Yeah, just you saying that makes me think, like, if, you know, 2 people out of 30 people in an English classroom really take Walden to heart, like, if everyone's reading it in their high school English classroom, that's, you know, millions and millions of people over time, that is really quite an effect of something he wrote. Well, something that I guess he wrote the journals of that became it and started to write it while at the pond, but came back into town and continued writing. And also, while you point out in the introduction that he was involved in a lot of these struggles, such as abolition, but wasn't a key organizer in any sense. I kind of get the sense that he wasn't really a joiner, as we might say, but that still, you know, one of the things in Laura Dessau Wall's biography of him that came out a few years ago, one of the things I think about the most is the Lyceum she talks about. It was basically like, you know, a town speaker series, and they voted for Thoreau to basically coordinate it, and he'd bring in all these outside speakers about the topics of the day, and he'd, you know, bring in radical abolitionists or whoever else, and just kind of the way in which, why that has stuck out to me and stayed with me is that sometimes I feel like we miss forums like that where it's not, where obviously it would be self-selected who attended the Lyceum, but it's a little bit like anyone around would go to it. And people could talk afterward and kind of, I was not there and don't know much about it, but I imagine they, you know, discuss the issues of the day and learn about it and kind of interact with each other and learn from each other in a way that we're maybe more self-selecting, for good reason, it makes sense to be more self-selecting. And when you're getting news through the internet or avenues that are not localized. And I think there are...
Podcasts are different from the Lyceum.
Yes. Even, you know, if I want this to be my, you know, me coordinating my personal Lyceum, I'm not going to get my next door neighbor to come over and talk about it. And I don't know my next door neighbor. I just moved here, but... I would like to.
Yeah, I do think that you're putting your finger on something really important, which is just that, like, we live in a very different time, and one of those important differences is this thing about, I don't know, polarization. Sometimes people say whatever it is. It does seem like finding ways to meet your neighbors. I mean, I do that. I have volunteered at a local community garden and a public housing program that does food systems kinds of activities, projects, and that's been so meaningful for me just as a way to meet my neighbors. You know, it's you're right that there just aren't that many sort of public spaces where people come together just because they live near each other, and those spaces where they still exist are really valuable.
Too many fences, maybe. I think, yeah, one thing I do want to make sure we explore a bit further before we finish up that we've touched on a few times is this idea of joy that, you know, when, like, I ride the bike partly because I'm worried about carbon emissions, but also riding the bike is really fun, and I get endorphins, and when I'm sitting in traffic, I'm unhappy. I was before Detroit, where I am now, I was living in the Los Angeles area, and really just like driving to LA and sitting in traffic is like some of my darkest moments, you know?
It's a very bad time.
And for Thoreau, you know, people, if the conception of him is you know, simplify, renounce things. Like, it's like we were saying, he was also going on great walks and watching cool critters and, you know, enjoying his food that he grew and, like, genuinely, like, loves the world in a way that I find really inspiring. You have a quote from him in the book that's, like, joy is the condition, or joy must be the condition of life, or something like that, where just he sees joy in the world around him. It rubs off on him. When I read his journals, part of what's so charming about it is, like, you'll get these philosophical ruminations or political thoughts, but it's mostly him just being like, I saw a pretty flower today. Like, it was this species, you know, like, it's, he loved the world around him in a way that I think is both inspiring, and I think useful to say, no, we're not asking you to renounce, like, fast fashion, buying new clothes every week because you have to live like a monk, or, you know, maybe, I don't know, maybe monks are, have more fun than people think, but we're at, you know, part of why we ask you to do it is because when you're not spending all your money on fast fashion or spending all your time, like, there's this, the rest of the world around us we can pay attention to, which part, I don't know, even as I say it, part of me is like, maybe that's snobby and people do genuinely get joy out of fast fashion and yada yada, but part of me thinks it's beautiful.
Yeah, totally. And I think one of the beautiful things about Walden is that, like, the way you put it was, we're not asking you to for this reason, we're asking you to for this other reason. Thoreau doesn't really ask you for anything in Walden. What he does is try to entice you. He says, look at what it's like when I do it. Don't you want to do it with me? He's like what I describe it in the book as a seduction to the good. It's a rhetoric that's not about argumentation or persuasion through reasoning. It's images and stories about what a beautiful life is. And so he's not asking you to do anything at all. He's saying, look what happened to me. It was so good for me.
I love that.
I looked up this morning. So his 100th birthday was 5 years ago. So 100 years ago,
200, he would have been
200. No.
No. Wait. What year is it? 5 years ago was 2017.
Right. 200.
Uh-huh.
Is that right? Yes.
Yes. Yes. His 200th
yes,
birthday.
Yes. 200. Thank you, Dayton. He would have been 5 years old 200 years ago. So I tried to find something about his being 5 years old. And in fact, he wrote in his journal about how 23 years since, when I was 5 years old, I was brought from Boston to this pond away in the country. That woodland vision for a long time made the drapery of my dreams. This is in Laura Dowsett Wall's biography. And she writes about how his spirit longed for the sweet solitude, as he wrote, that he saw there. Let's see. He was living in Boston at the time, and it wasn't like that tumultuous and varied city, but where sunshine and shadow were the only inhabitants that varied the scene. And his whole life sort of like longed for what that meant to him when he was 5 years old. And I think it's because of this, the thing you're describing, like it was a place and a life that he enjoyed.
Yeah. I, you know, with all the caveats of, I think there are things, you know, to improve upon Thoreau. There he has his the things he doesn't see and his mistakes and his faults, as we all do. But I do still feel that there's just such an important point to learn from my high school English assignment of walking around the pond and just noticing, paying attention to what's around me. So yeah, I think I hope to, I'm in a new city, hope to learn some of the local flora and fauna while I'm here. And that's all I had for you in terms of, you know, prepared possible questions, I think, but just, is there anything else you want to add or bring up or talk about?
Let me think for a second. I'm wondering if the passage from the journals is better than me, like, trying to summarize what Laura Dessal wrote. Yeah, and he writes about thronging guests. So she only takes these passages out about sweet solitude and no one else being around. But so I'm just going to read what he wrote in the journal. 23 years since, when I was 5 years old, I was brought from Boston to this pond away in the country, which was then but another name for the extended world for me, one of the most ancient scenes stamped on the tablets of my memory. That sweet solid, no, that woodland vision for a long time made the drapery of my dreams. That sweet solitude my spirit seemed so early to require that I might have room to entertain my thronging guests, and that speaking silence that my ears might distinguish the significant sounds. So I love this passage because it's about how going to the woods was important to him from when he was 5 years old. It like marks this moment in his life when he saw what he wanted a long time made the drapery of my dreams. And the reason was that the solitude allowed him to entertain his thronging guests, which I don't know about you, but I definitely have this experience about having many thronging guests that require a lot of attention, even when there's no one around. And silence that so that he could listen to what the sounds were that really mattered. And I think that's the main point about asceticism, is that the one that I'm most interested in, is just that it's this calling toward the way we really want to spend our time, the guests we actually want to entertain, and the sounds we ought to be listening out for. To be discerning about those questions seems like sort of the most political act.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. Thanks for sharing that full journal entry, and thank you for spending the last hour talking with me about Thoreau. This was great.
Yeah, it's so fun, Dayton. Thank you.
All right, the book is Thoreau's Religion, Walden Woods, Social Justice, and the Politics of Asceticism.
Hope you got something out of that interview. I certainly did. One thing you may have gotten out of it is that there are apparently a bunch of trucks that were going by my window, some birds singing. I like to think at least Thoreau wouldn't mind the birds, but I tried to edit out most of the truck noises. Apologize if there were still some in there. Yeah, I think this was a really useful conversation on its own, and also as a continuation of past ones we've had about, you know, degrowth perspectives and post-growth perspectives on this podcast. I think something I'm hoping to explore in future episodes is how that connects to, you know, things that might be more conventionally political organizing activism. But yeah, I think this is really an important piece of things, and as Aldo points out, Thoreau clearly had influence because we're still talking about him 205 years later. I think that the journal entry she ended on is a great way to end, so I won't say more other than to ask you to please consider supporting this podcast on Patreon, patreon.com/storytellingpod. If you give a small monthly donation, you can basically just make sure that this podcast keeps going, that I get better equipment. I'm considering upgrading my website, stuff like that. And I can't do it without you. So hope you're having a good day. Hope this podcast helped you have a good day. And until next time. Thank you.